Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, you're listening to Subda.
It's a show where we talk to interesting people about documentary films that they have strong opinions about. I'm George Chen.
And I'm Paco Romain.
And on this episode of SupDoc, we discuss the documentary Kurt Cobain, Montage of Heck, a film by Brett Morgan and available on HBO Go. Our guest for this week is Adam Fowler, drummer with the legendary punk band Jawbreaker and co-owner of Lost Weekend Video, one of San Francisco's remaining video stores. Adam and his band Jawbreaker toured with Nirvana in the mid-1990s.
Before we get into it, I did have one question from Periscope. We're doing a live Periscope of this. Someone asked, how did we like the animations in Montage of Heck, which is the movie we're talking about, the Kurt Cobain Montage of Heck?
I liked it. I thought it was interesting. It seems to be like a style that a lot of documentaries are using these days, where they stylize narrative with animation.
I thought it made the movie even darker. Like a lot of those, the animated stuff was just, there's like raining all the time, and it made it look really, it was somber. It really brought it down and made that dude's sort of shut-in life seem even more alienating, mm-hmm. or alienated, I guess I should say. Mm-hmm. But I liked it a lot. I thought it was cool, that sort of weird. Like, obviously, it looked to me like they did sort of rotoscoping or something, yeah. where they had actors doing moves and then they would just go over that with color and lines or whatever.
Like Richard Linklater did with Scanner Darkly.
Right.
It's based on the rotoscoping idea, but it was like computerized.
Right. Yeah, Ralph, I don't know. Ralph I just Bakshi. Know that. Right. Yeah, that's why I know Bakshi's that word, style. I think, is from those films.
Right. It was just like you have someone as a stand-in for Cobain and then they just digitize like the face over it.
Right.
It definitely made it seem more like a comic book. It sort of had it made it real extra moody. It just was a way to illustrate stuff they obviously didn't have footage of.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it really, this movie seemed to me, I mean, all documentaries are like this, in that you're sort of, unless you're doing like a Wiseman doc where you turn the camera on and let it ride, you're sort of culling together and you're building your narrative out of footage that already exists and different sources, you know, interviews from now, and then whatever else you don't have, you just got to fill in the blanks. That seems like a good way to fill in the blanks, I think.
Yeah.
Are people shit-talking it, or is it...
No, it's just, I think it was just, that's just one question we got off Periscope.
Right, well, plus, I mean, Brett Morgan, he's known for that. He's like the guy that really brought that, that sort of popularized that in the documentary form. Really?
What else did he work on?
He did The Kid Stays in the Picture.
Yeah. Oh, same guy.
And he did Chicago 12?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Right. And so kids taking the still and being able to like animate the still photo or still.
Well, that's kind of like, that's like an Errol Morris, right?
Yeah, Ken Burns.
Or Ken Burns, rather.
Yeah, Errol Morris both used that technique. But Brett Morgan is the one that brought that into the forefront of documentary filmmaking, especially with Kids Days in the Picture, which, by the way, is one of my all-time favorites.
It's great. It's amazing. I really like Brett's movies.
Yeah, me too.
He's a guy. He actually went, me and Blake went to school with Brett.
Really?
Yeah, he was a couple of years below us.
It's a connection I didn't even know about this. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not, you know, we're acquaintances. We have friends in common.
You and Boxenbaum and Brett Morgan and Blake all went to high school.
Well, not
together,
only that, or? yeah, but also my friend Nicole Hirsch shot the interviews for the Cobain thing, and I didn't even know that until the other day. Someone brought up, congratulated her on Facebook or something, and I was like, oh my god, it's Nicole. Like, Nicole I've known forever since high school.
Like all the interviews with the present day interviews.
Yeah. Yeah, and my friend Andy did the titles for it. Like, all these people from Crossroads worked on this movie.
Uh-huh. Is this like a private school you guys went to?
Yeah.
Where is this, like, Ojai or something? Is it that school I've heard
No, but there would be a retreat to Ojai at the end of everyone's senior year.
So you guys all went to, like, a kind of elite, it's kind of an elite private high school?
Yeah.
Like, everyone from there seems like they were doing something successful?
Yeah, there's that. There's a lot of kids that came out of there that are, I mean, these are
people, Hollywood kids too.
Well, yeah, but P.S. I haven't spoken to these guys in over 25 years or whatever, mm-hmm. that the people I'm talking about, except mm-hmm. for Andy. Andy I still work with, mm-hmm. and no, he's one of my best friends. But Andy, he's a graphic designer and a fine artist and stuff. So he's helped me with some of my stuff.
Oh, really?
Like recently.
Oh, like the reissues of the records and stuff?
Yeah, and he designed my logo and.
Oh, really?
He's going to help us with the titles for our documentary.
Right.
But so, this isn't about me. But there were all these connections that I realized, like, oh my god, that's funny.
Yeah.
But not, you know, these, like I said, it's been 20. Over 25 years since I've heard.
Where
from
I don't know where is Crossroads?
It's in Santa Monica.
Oh, mm-hmm. In Santa Monica, so L.A. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I was picturing East Coast for some reason.
It sounds well. I mean,
it sounds kind of East Coast, especially when like you're like mentioning filmmakers and you're a musician. And
there's a lot of people came out of that school that did really well for themselves.
Yeah.
And a lot of them, you know, there was a lot of like you said, it was kind of a Hollywood. Like that's where. The film people,
like the children of the film people, went there.
Totally.
But also that also sort of places it generationally. It's like all people that were kind of around the same age as Kurt, or like peers with Kurt. And I'd say like you guys were basically peers with Nirvana, like age wise, right? Or slightly younger.
Like no,
you guys
no,
all started in like 88, 89.
No, we're all. I think we're all this pretty much the same age.
Yeah. So, and putting together. For those of you who don't know, so Adam was in Jawbreaker, started with your friend from high school. Did you guys start right after out of high school, or you started in college?
No, our first band was in high school.
Okay.
We played together in like 1983 or something.
Whoa. And then the reason I pulled you in is I know that you actually did a tour with Nirvana.
Right.
I didn't know all these other connections you actually had to Brett Morgan or these other people. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that when... you asked me to do this, and I didn't know how, you know, but like it doesn't really bring it. I'm a fan of that guy's movies anyway,
right?
And I'm happy for Nicole and stuff. Mm-hmm. But there's all these weird, strange connections, and the more I thought about it, the more they came up. You know, just the people that I've met recently that were tight with Kurt and them. A good friend, you know, and other good friends of mine that worked for Kurt and Courtney. There's a lot of weird little connections in there, and it makes it sound more glamorous than it really is, because honestly, this is a million years ago.
But that's also, I think, is interesting about this documentary, is you really see how, like, there was a point where if you're just in a West Coast little punk band, you kind of were in the same community and peers with these people, and
for
it
sure
wasn't, it wasn't an out of reach thing, and it wasn't like
not
this,
at all
this you know, distance. It was a very like I know other people that are connected to those guys
for sure, and they were down to earth, and the more I thought about our past And when we started playing and stuff, I started connecting all these dots. Like, I was just thinking, someone posted some footage from L7's show last night at the Echoplex.
Did they just play a show last night?
Yeah, and okay. I was like, oh, wait, that's funny, because I used to work at Nana Warehouse in Santa Monica, and the people that worked at Nana, like, I worked with D, the drummer of L7. And so it was kind of like those guys that got me, that played Nirvana for me for the first time, because they were doing shows with them. And Dee's husband plays the cello on Something in the Way on Nevermind. And there was all these little, like, I remember, like, it was probably Dee or my old bosses at Nana Warehouse that played like Bleach and Sliver.
Yeah.
For me, for the first time, I had no idea that was going on. And when Nirvana was recording Nevermind, they played a secret show at Jabberjaw.
Oh, they did?
Yeah.
Oh.
And like, so...
Because they were recording with Butch Vig, and that was in L.A.? I thought he was a Chicago guy.
No, they were recording in the Valley.
Valley, okay.
At that place at Sound City, that place where Dave Grohl made the documentary.
That other how did you feel about that documentary? I didn't see that one yet, the Sound City one.
It was cool. I thought it was great. It reminded me of about something I had just had recently heard, that Marc Maron actually talking about sort of the magic in machines or something, you know. And that really resonated. And then I thought of that when I watched Sound City, of just because it was really about this kind of magical place and the people.
Right, the guy
and the board, it, like, almost literally how, you know, just so much cable coming from the board into the room somehow translated into all these amazing records.
And didn't Grohl buy it? Didn't he buy the board?
Yeah, he's like in his garage, I guess.
Yeah,
that brings me to...
Anyway, I'm jumping all over the place. Fine. But as I thought about this, I was like, oh my God, that's right, because D from L7 like kind of played... turned us on to Nirvana, but way back in the day.
That's kind of how back in the day you were turned on to music. It wasn't certainly radio. It wasn't because you saw it on YouTube or Facebook or Twitter. Like, someone older than you, cooler than you, hipper than you, generally like an older brother in my case.
Right, for sure.
I had two of them where I would go through their album. I'm like, what's The Cramps? My brother's like, just listen to it, you know. But that's how it used to work. That's how... you used to get turned on to music, was someone older and cooler than you.
Yeah, yeah.
Paco, what do you remember first hearing Nirvana? Do you remember?
Oh, yes, definitely. I heard them. A friend had a cassette at a house party, and we used to have, it was called the Pseudo Pit, this place in Kalamazoo, Michigan, where I'm from, that hosted a lot of punk bands that would play in the Pseudo Pit, which was the basement, and we would go down there and listen to music with our friends, smoke weed, drink 40s, and listen to cassettes. And I remember hearing that first, and then like a year later on radio, you know, you'd hear them on the radio.
So not college radio for you. Kalamazoo had a college.
Yeah, WIDR 89.1. Kalamazoo, Michigan. Yeah,
love Kalamazoo.
Oh, you do?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a great town.
Yeah, we played there a bunch.
Yeah, that town had a very punk ethic. You know, Kalamazoo is always into like the punk scene. And matter of fact, a friend of mine who used to work at Flipside Records was saying that he was going to tune in because he really was a big fan of Jawbreaker back in the day. And, there was a college radio station. But by the time Nirvana got big, college radio stations were like, they're too big. We're not going to play Nirvana, thing.
Right.
Well, I mean, I remember hearing Smells Like Teen Spirit. I'm thinking I did hear something earlier. Like, I definitely heard Love Buzz at some point before that, but I wasn't like hip to, like, I didn't have Bleach or anything like that. But I remember hearing Smells Like Teen Spirit, I think maybe on college radio, or it was like very shortly it came out, and then it was all over like Live 105 and things.
Oh,
like,
yeah,
that. But it was like definitely stood out as a moment of like, when I heard that, I'm like, there's something going on here.
Right.
It's definitely,
I saw them.
OC change.
I saw them play. We had a little tiny bar called Club Soda. Mm-hmm. I saw them play.
That's where we played.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah, that's where everyone played. And, you know, held maybe 50 to 100 people max. But then I saw them a year later at Wing Stadium, our hockey arena, with the Boredoms. The Boredoms opened up for them.
Yeah, I love the Boredoms.
And It was incredible. I mean, everybody was kind of freaked out by the boredoms, but then, you know, Nirvana came on and put the Band-Aid on the show, as it were. But yeah, I mean, that's just what happened. Like, 1 year, tiny venue, not a lot of people. Next year, arena, you know?
Yeah. For sure. Well, so I remember hearing Bleach. Actually, wasn't Bleach, the vinyl of Bleach, I think, was on
Sub Pop, right?
But it was like, I think Tupelo licensed it for Europe or something. They had it. I know Gary was dealing with Nirvana, and he got into heaps of trouble after they broke.
Wow.
They stole that record back from him or something.
Oh, like he had some legal battle with them?
Yeah, or maybe he might have had like the Sliver 12-inch or something. He had one of those early things.
As a distributor that also Jawbreaker was on that label at the time. Or was it Tupelo or was it Communion?
It's kind of all the same
thing.
The Revolver people down there. But I remember hearing Bleach and being like, this is cool, this is heavy. But then I remember distinctly being unloading a truck at Nana. Nana was like the punk rock store in Los Angeles that sold like punk gear from way back in the day. And they became the only importer of Doc Martin and Creepers and Monkey Boots and stuff. So they would so we would ship to all the other punk rock places, like, you know, in Chicago and New York and wherever, Austin. So we would, you know, we would unload these massive trucks from like wherever, from Czechoslovakia or something. And we would just listen to blast. They would put the speakers out the window and just blast music. And I remember distinctly hearing Sliver for the first time, and then going in and going, like, asking, what was that? What was that one? Like, because that one sounded really good to me. Mm-hmm. And then D tells us about these guys playing down at Jabberjaw, and we go and see them play at Jabberjaw to like 200 people, and like thousands of people claim to have been at the show.
Right.
But I remember being there, and apparently Iggy Pop was there, and like, it's where Kurt met Courtney that. Anyway, so this like amazing
place. And that's in Los Angeles.
That's in Los Angeles on Pico. That was on Los Angeles on Pico Boulevard near...
Went. I've heard a lot about it.
It was great. It was like, it was tiny, and
it was the smell, like the equivalent thing of like the smell, I guess.
Probably. Smaller, a lower stage. They just sold like soda and junk food and had some.
And it was all ages. That was the most important thing about it. It was one of the only all ages shows.
Yeah. It was amazing. It was a great show. But I remember here, so me and Blake go see Nirvana at Jabberjaw, and they played Smells Like Teen Spirit. And we both said that one, and I'm not saying this to make it sound like I called it or whatever, but I remember saying, me and Blake talking about, like, sounds like a kind of like a Pixies riff, doesn't it? That one. Did you like that one that had that kind of Pixies beginning? And then we were.
Yeah. I could see that now. I never would have. It's so much its own thing and so iconic to me now that I wouldn't have thought about it as how it's. There's definitely a lot of Pixies in.
But those, like, just two notes, the two notes, and how it kind of is it's kind of quiet, and it's just those two notes.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, that actually brings back, like, the Pixies are kind of, like, attributed a lot of the entire, like, quiet, loud dynamic is kind of attributed to the Pixies in general.
Right.
And they were, they never quite made it to the level that, obviously, Nirvana ever did. But
I thought
still, like,
they did.
Huge, like, influential band.
They were big. I mean, the Pixies were big.
They were major labels.
I thought they were huge.
Yeah.
The late 80s, the Pixies were huge, it seems like.
They were definitely influential, yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But going back,
I think those guys would have been the first to admit it, too.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they've said as much in the press about that song particularly. But anyway.
But there was something that stood out about that song for sure.
Yeah, but they were all great. I mean, it was an amazing show, and they were all great. But I remember not having heard that song and then going like, oh, that one.
Mm-hmm. That's what surprised me in the documentary, was seeing Kurt's dedication to the craft and his, like, this is how we're going to make it. Like, in his notebook, he was like, get microphones, send out cassettes, damn it, get signed, become famous. You know, like, I think a lot of people think he had this kind of quality to himself where I'm like, I just want to play guitar, man. And if it leads to chicks and money, that's cool. But it seems like really he was like, very proactive in his own fame, you know.
Well, I would say there's...
Well,
like
and worked at it, yeah. I mean, you have to, right?
You have to, yeah. Exactly.
I mean, you see, the thing that jumped out at me from that page was where he says, you have to practice 5 times a week.
Right.
Yeah.
Which that's very few too. Bands yeah. will practice 5 times
that's
a week.
That's bordering on James Brown kind of stuff.
That's yeah. that's a lot.
That actually reminds me of like advice I got when I started stand-up, which is do it 4 times a week. I mean, that's... You do need like this extreme dedication, but then not like coordinating with 3 other people's like schedules
right.
and like day jobs and school and whatnot. But yeah, I think that is one thing that is in there. It's like there's this idea that he's this very pure artist. And I think just because he was trying to get on a label or like follow these steps doesn't take that away. But definitely like they wanted an audience. They just got a lot more than he could handle.
Yeah.
That's what I took away from it. The actual fame and like the music press and the attention is different. Even if you might abstractly think you want it, then when you actually have to deal with it, that was a lot for him. That's yeah. what I take away from it. And like that's kind of been, I think, an idea that's been around for a long time. Like they came from this super DIY place. They were like just trying to get advice from like the Melvins and stuff, and they were peers with all like the Riot Girl people. So their relationship with the media, like he had such disdain in those interviews with any media interviews he was doing. Like he just did not care. He was pretty checked out, it seemed like. So like they
yeah, or goofing attention. Or goofing on it, kind of winking to yeah. his earlier fans. Like I know that you know that this yes. is fucking crazy and ridiculous
yeah.
and
yeah.
There was a lot of winking. They're like the 90s Beatles in that media way. You know, the Beatles are like, I don't know, Colt Henry.
Yeah, and there's yeah. nothing. And there's nothing more embarrassing than like having someone put a mic in your face and ask you like for the umpteenth time, like, where'd you get the name? Or like,
yeah,
what? So Jawbreaker.
No, I mean, no. That was nothing. To...
But yeah, speaking of that, there was one little bit that I saw online. You know, when he is supposed to be coming out and performing one show where he's being wheeled out in the wheelchair and he's got the wig on, he's
yeah.
in the hospital gown.
Yes.
Like, he's just kind of playing on this idea that he's this, you know, totally
sickly,
weak junkie. And the person that's pushing the wheelchair is Everett True, the rock writer, who is really responsible for, like, popularizing the term grunge or, like, really...
Oh, I didn't
yeah,
know that,
Everett
too.
True. Yeah, I saw that somewhere that was Everett True. But yeah, he had some connection to wanting to control the media perception of him, you know?
Right. Absolutely. Well, I mean,
or acknowledging it. Yeah.
And the 90s, I think, is when the cavalcade of the uber celebrity really started happening too, because of, you know, it was kind of still pre-internet, but yeah. it was getting to the point where like tabloid fodder was everything. I mean, especially with the Kurt Courtney stuff. I mean, it was all over the place.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That was a narrative that got totally out of control, I think. That.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I mean, I actually found myself being more empathetic towards Courtney after watching this than I think I had at any other point. I mean, I think she does seem like fairly obnoxious presence, but still, like, the way they are with each other and the way they are with Francis, it feels pretty authentic. It feels
yeah.
like it's not a... There's a weird thing where I was thinking about, there's these really intimate moments between Kurt and Courtney, and then there's a third person filming it all, so that seems strange. I'm like, is that Eric? Who is that? That's just, like, a friend who's hanging out with them, but, given all that, like, you know, they just seem like a young couple in love.
Yeah.
And that's, like, I something that I haven't really thought of, because not that I believe any conspiracy theories or anything like that. It's just the way things have panned out, it's very easy to see her as a very opportunistic person.
Yeah, there was all that stuff about how, oh, Courtney didn't write the whole songs, and there was, like, oh, she's, like, Yoko Ono breaking up the, you know, like, she was yeah. this, like,
sinister.
Poisonous presence or something, but, you know, we weren't there for that, but I think that they kind of pinned that on her pretty early on, and then...
Mm-hmm. So, legitimately, she... Well, so what she says is that she's not the one who got him into heroin.
Right.
She was like, I had already gone through that. he was into it, and me being with him led me to be back into it. So it's portrayed often as she's the one that hooked him or something. But the
right.
quote that she said I thought was interesting. It was like, $3 million and I'm just going to become a junkie. That's like a quote that she attributes to him.
Once he gets $3 million in
yeah,
the bank
like
or
once
something?
He gets $3 million.
that was pretty shocking. Yeah, I thought that was pretty shocking.
So I have another $3 million to go then before I become a junkie.
$299 million
Yeah. And we were talking about this the other day, but it's shitty, you know, and it's shitty they did that to Yoko
right.
in the first place.
Yeah.
But she really took a whole lot of heat. And I, you know, I don't know her. I met her a few times.
Yeah.
But
in that early LA, early 90s LA scene? Or?
You've met Yoko?
Totally.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's.
Where? How?
No, we're talking.
Courtney.
Oh. Sorry.
Courtney Love, yeah. Like in that early 90s?
In or? Like, no, when we.
When you were on the tour?
When we toured, yeah.
Yeah. Well, so what year was that tour that Jawbreaker and Nirvana went on tour together?
That was 90. That was like. 93 was the October. I had to look it up myself. October of 93,
mm-hmm.
which is just before. It's like In Utero tour, where they weren't. I think in everyone's mind, like when they broke so big, everyone you see in your mind, you see 300,000 people in front of the stage, but all that footage, I'm assuming, was sort of like those big festivals, like mm-hmm. Reading and stuff.
Yeah, Europe stuff.
But when we went out with them, they were still we were playing to more people than we'd ever played to ever, but it seemed kind of scaled down. It was like
maybe like the Warfield or
couple
something.
Couple thousand people yeah. seated play. Like the biggest place was like a basketball stadium or something mm. and that was not totally filled up with people, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. We were playing like sheds, but they weren't. It wasn't like what you think of when you think of Nirvana playing to, you know, some massive outdoor.
Why do you think that is?
Well, it was like it was their headlining tour. It wasn't like they were. It wasn't a festival thing. It was just there that these are the places right. that they were playing.
Yeah,
we played the Aragon two nights in a row in Chicago. We played the Aragon.
Uh-huh. That's a great.
Yeah, because they would still like. I mean, right before they would still be like an opening act for the Pixies. I guess 2 years. Earlier, I guess right before
right.
Nevermind drops, they're like still like an opening act for the Pixies.
So I mean, the places like were huge, but I remember thinking, "Wow, this is like kind of scaled down." It seemed for them or something, but I don't think it was. I mean, that's just where they were.
Mm-hmm.
They were doing it. Plus, our leg of the tour was like Albuquerque to Milwaukee or something. It was mm-hmm. sort of like the middle.
Oh wow.
Swing or whatever.
Do you remember getting asked to do that? Did you go? Was it through a booking agent or a manager or something?
They called Blake, I think, and asked him.
Did he have some kind of relationship with them, or just had? It was just like a punk, like we all have each other's numbers kind of thing, or?
I don't know. I don't even remember how. I think I don't know. I think we knew Callie. Who was
right.
Kurt and Courtney's nanny?
Yeah, I know Callie,
who
yeah.
suggested us to Kurt. He played Kurt our music, and then the Wipers were supposed to be on that tour, and they didn't do it for whatever reason. Yeah. So we were filling in for the Wipers. So it was Jawbreaker, Mudhoney, and Nirvana for that little.
Oh wow!
For that, you know, it was just a week. So I don't know, like I'm saying, I don't, like you have as much knowledge from that movie probably of Kurt and Courtney and all them as I do from being mm-hmm. in that little amount of time. I mean, yeah. I would never pretend to have said these were my friends. They were mm-hmm. my contemporaries, I
right.
guess, and they were nice enough to invite us along, but, you know, I'm not tied with those people.
But yeah. you were basically.
I have an impression yeah. of them for sure yeah. from that tour, and that's as much informed from like, their story later on mm-hmm. and how it tragically ended is, you know.
But you were definitely, I would say, you guys, by nature of what you guys were doing, you were more peers with them than, like, the Red Hot Chili Peppers were peers with them or, like, you know, Guns N' Roses or the bands they get compared to in the press.
Yeah,
just
maybe.
Because you came from a similar world, like an MRR
maybe.
Kind of world.
Right.
Which I think people don't really understand now, even though MRR is still there. Like, the independent music scene before Nirvana and even immediately after is so different than compared to, like, 2015 music scene where
right.
everything is a completely different thing.
Right.
But, like, in a sense, what happened with Jawbreaker, like in terms of getting interest from these bigger places, had to be directly a result of the fact that Nirvana was a success story.
For sure.
And so in a way, like this picture of this like really late 80s, early 90s independent music scene, you guys were like contemporaries and peers in that way.
I guess, yeah.
Yeah.
Did you see a spike in album sales after your tour?
You know, we didn't really pay attention to that stuff. Mm-hmm. We weren't sound scanning because we were on an indie, so we didn't. There was no like empiric. There was nothing to sort of.
There's no metric back.
Yeah,
we need more records.
Now everyone knows exactly how many records everyone's selling, but I remember not knowing anything about that until much later.
Hmm. Right, like, and you'd have cassettes also. So
I would call. You know, I call Revolver and be like, "Can you know? We're going on tour. Can do you have some records you can give me to sell?"
What album were you touring on?
I think it must have been
Bivouac.
Like, yeah, it was after
24-Hour Revenge Therapy had come out.
That came out in like 94, I think.
So yeah, you had recorded it by then or no?
Because
you guys recorded with Albini too. That's the other connection.
Oh yeah, okay. So when we went on tour with Nirvana, we had recorded 24-Hour Revenge Therapy. It hadn't come out yet though. Mm-hmm. Right. That's true.
Yeah, and I don't know if like...
Wait, I have a question.
Yeah.
Are we supposed to be talking about this documentary, or is this like an interview about Jawbreaker?
Like, okay. We kind of do both. Like
because I'm not... I didn't know. I didn't know what I was walking into, kind of. I didn't know how much...
I think there's like connections. I mean, like the fact that you both recorded with Albini, you did this tour together. Like
this podcast sort of is called This Is Your Life.
But it's like... But are we supposed to be talking mostly about?
We can get back to montage.
No, no, I'm happy to go through it. But yeah. I like the timeline isn't really clear in my head.
Right. The fact that you guys both worked with Albini, it's not like he was sitting there talking about it or anything. Or
Albini?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Oh, he was talking about working with them.
Yeah.
Yeah. What kind of?
Because we were like, well, how was that? You know.
Yeah.
Did you go to Chicago?
We went to Chicago. Yeah.
Oh wow! Did he have the jumpsuit?
He was probably pretty snappy and had his hat and stuff.
Nice.
It was rad. I mean, you know, that's a hero of ours. And
yeah.
And when we heard the advance of In Utero, we were like, holy shit, this is gnarly. This is like a heavy record. And so, you know, knowing Big Black and all that stuff, we were like, let's go do it with him. Yeah. And he was super cheap.
Yeah,
we
that's the thing. It's crazy. He's still pretty cheap.
Oh, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
So, like, if he had taken any points for any of the albums that he had produced, he'd be, like, some multi-millionaire, I would think, at this point.
Yeah, that's the thing.
He doesn't, right? He just takes session fees.
In Grohl's thing on HBO... The
Sonic Highway?
Yeah, they talk about, like, basically, he's like, I like to be paid like a plumber. Like, pay me hourly for my work.
Yeah.
And he doesn't take points.
Right, like he's a union guy or something.
Yeah. That's so great.
And, yeah, to possibly his detriment, but, I mean... If he's the guy who is the most defining of the certain kind of...
He also works on a sliding scale, though. When I called him up and said, hey, you know, Gary held at Revolt, we're going to put this record out. He was like, I'll give you the, you know, it'll be nothing.
Yeah.
And sure enough, he charged us just a little over $1,000 to make our record.
Wow.
Yeah, like tape and then just the days.
I don't even know what I'm doing, and I would charge somebody $1,000.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've never recorded anybody.
No, it was amazing.
Yeah.
Super cheap. But, you know, on the heels of Nevermind, Nirvana shows up. I'm sure he got paid. I think, you know, I remember hearing Kurt joking that, you know, well, we gave him $1 million or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was true, but.
So to get back to the doc.
Yeah.
One of the things that, like, I thought it was interesting to, I mean, okay, let me preface this with saying there's a million articles, a bunch of books, and already a doc that's come out about Kurt Cobain prior to this. I was really surprised that they were able to squeeze even more information out about Kurt and especially his early life. I thought it was interesting how much he seemed to be affected by his parents' divorce.
Yeah, I found that interesting too, yeah.
And, I mean, it seemed like, I don't know if your parents are divorced. My parents are divorced too, and I remember it sucking, but I was just like, you know, didn't seem to take it as hard as Kurt, but everyone deals with it themselves. But then the stealing of the alcohol story,
mm-hmm. right?
With the
that's a really intense story where his sexual experience with the
differently abled
girl who's like, yeah, it's unclear exactly what is going on with her, but
they were calling him retard fucker,
yeah,
at school and stuff, and that seemed to really affect him.
Yeah,
they tied that in with his. This sort of theme of him being really adverse to criticism and ridicule and humiliation. Mm-hmm. Like they said that came up a bunch of times. It like Chris did. Novoselic talked about it. And
well, that's armor, right? I mean, that's someone's armor when they're like when people who are adverse to not being criticized and being humiliated, it's because they've built up this armor around themselves. And what that does is it takes a chunk out of your armor when you're being humiliated. That means you're not on top. I think a lot of people go into comedy that feel that way, mm-hmm. you know, because you want to be the first person to get to the joke before someone else can.
Right. Like it's a very developed defense mechanism, right?
Yeah.
Like you know, who said that? Marin has said this before, this idea that you're controlling how people are laughing at you,
right?
When you're taking that initiative,
yeah.
He seemed very sensitive about the divorce, and what I thought was interesting is like how they described him as being so hyper, because that's not the impression you get of him as being this ball of energy, but you can see how it gets internalized and comes out as like drawing and writing and music, but just him being like a hyper kid that they just feed him some kind of Ritalin when he's like. 9 or something.
Yeah.
That was big in this, you know, if you came of age in the 70s or whatever, and if you were a hyperactive kid, that they would call you, that was like some words they threw around a lot, you're hyperactive. Yeah. They said the same thing about me. I never was on Ritalin, but I remember people being like my mom being like, go run around the block.
Get that out.
You gotta get your yayas out or whatever. You either, you know, but in the 70s, I think you either gave your kid Ritalin or you like enrolled them in every mm-hmm. sport that right. they could right. possibly get you.
Or if you lived in the country like we did, my dad would just lock the door behind us. Just kick us out. We'll lock the door. Come back when you're tired. You know?
For sure.
Yeah, I feel like I should have gotten Ritalin and I didn't get it. Like
you might have been gypped.
I think that maybe it was just the fact that like my parents are immigrants and they were not like into this therapy culture. Or maybe no one actually... I definitely remember seeing like child psychologists and I'm surprised that was never on offer. Like, hey, try putting him on this.
Right.
And that didn't really come up. Or maybe it did, and I was not privy to that conversation because I was a minor.
Right.
So anyway, this is turning into me, the me story. But that actually brings me back to a thing I thought about when watching this.
Is it politically incorrect to say gypped now?
Yeah, I think so.
It is?
Yeah,
my apologies.
What is that?
Cut that out.
My apologies.
The Roma
to
people? The gypsy
Oh,
culture.
Gypsies, of course.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, well, there's some other words we could use. But we won't because that's not what we're talking about.
You got rooked. They should have given you some.
Chess is like neutral. No one cares sure. about chess.
Except it's black
the
against
chess
white.
People. Yeah, it's true. It is a race war. Othello is more of the race war than.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I love that game.
Yeah. My thought I had when I was watching this is there's this moment where you're just watching a teenager who is sullen and miserable and just wants to smoke pot and hang out in his room. And I was just thinking about how it's in a way lucky that then he's just in a popular band. Because there's so many people that just do those steps. And they're like, I'm
so
just going to be playing guitar in my room. Yeah. And then it never leads to anything.
It never come out.
Well, yeah. There's a dichotomy of Kurt Cobain that, I mean, he obviously he's a tortured genius type. But like that's the thing that got me, which was like, he's like, this is how you become a success. Then he becomes a success and he's like, I don't like success.
Yeah.
The same thing where I'm a tortured teenage kid. I just want to smoke pot. Yet I'm going to practice guitar all the time. I'm going to put a band together. I'm going to figure out how to do things. He's meticulous with his notes, even to the point where he's like, this is what the band's names are going to be.
Right.
And he's writing all those down like poopy butt. No, well, you know, this and, yeah. you know.
I feel like a lot of people in bands have probably done that, where they have that notepad.
For sure. But they didn't all keep them. That was another thing that I was really impressed by was that he kept all that stuff.
Archive. That's what's, all the notebooks, all the drawings. I know one of the notebooks got published.
Yeah.
A few, like 10 years ago.
The journal, the big oversized, like, coffee table journal book. Yeah, someone gave me that for my birthday or Christmas or something. And I never, I just kind of leafed through it, but I never really dove in because it just seemed kind of weird.
Well, then I'd have to ask this. Do you think he knew he was going to be famous and that's why he kept them around? Some people seem to have that thought. I heard once that Neil Young has kept everything that he's ever written on, even napkins. Like if he wrote like a lyric, he kept it because he knew he was going to be famous.
I don't know. Maybe it's just part of like people's artistic process or whatever. Just to keep shit.
But you keep like things from.
I'm an archivist in a similar way, but I don't. Mm. I'm not.
Like set lists? You have set lists?
Maybe.
Yeah.
I have a lot of stuff.
You have like show flyers.
Yeah.
Where is it kept? Passes. In your house? Or?
In bins and boxes and stuff in my basement.
Which is helpful since I can sidetrack too. There is a documentary about you guys that's being made by a guy that I knew from San Jose who went to high school with my sister, Keith Sharon.
Oh, that's right.
Oh, yeah. Wow. And he made We Jam Meccano, the great Minutemen documentary.
That's great.
Yeah. Which I think we're going to talk about later with someone.
Oh, nice. We should get Courtney Love to talk about the Jawbreaker documentary.
Yeah, that might be the thing to do. Well, actually, there should be just a documentary about her. That's what I kind of got out of this, too. I'm like, she's actually a pretty compelling character.
Well, she is because she's a character.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know how much. I don't know. Like I said, I didn't. Going back to what I said, I don't pretend to know these people. Yeah. I know people that know them. And, I know.
She'd been in a couple movies before.
Yeah, she was People versus bands. Larry Flint.
Well, no, that was after she'd already been in.
Was in Straight to Hell.
Straight to Hell. She was in Sid and Nancy.
Oh, like, yeah.
She's one of Nancy Spungen's friends in Sid and Nancy. You know, of all the most precursor things you could think of.
Well, that's when the documentary got really depressing to me. I mean, and I knew going in that it was going to be a sad affair. Yeah, you know what I mean? It was going to be a bummer, of course, because we all know how that story ends. And I wasn't sure I was that hungry for new information or stuff that I didn't know. But that section of the film right before like the end, like when MTV Unplugged is being filmed of them just being shut in. You were talking
the
two about
of them. Yeah.
Yeah. It was sweet when the baby came along, when Francis Bean is born or whatever. But when they're just kind of sitting around and just being, you know, doing drugs and hanging out, it's just that's, you know, you just automatically think, oh, it's like Sid and Nancy.
Yeah.
Like, I definitely thought that. Right,
you know.
I felt the same way. I was like, it's just kind of a story about a junkie at this point, you know, and that's how I felt. I was like, just another story about a junkie, especially when he was holding Francis and he's nodding out. You know,
yeah,
I think maybe his mom was like, let me take her.
Right.
You know, it's like, ugh.
Well, at that point in the movie, you're really like, man, you almost want to go get outside into the
daylight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really claustrophobic.
It does. Yeah. That's good filmmaking. Those are home movies, but there's like nowadays it's I think with documentary filmmaking they manipulate found footage a lot to help tell their story. In that they cleverly edit so that it helps with the narrative of the doc. But there was a moment when they're showing them in their house goofing around and I was just like, I just kind of want to open the curtains and lift up, you know, open the window for them.
Destroys that guitar.
Yeah.
Like clinging on him. And they're like, Eric from Hole is in one of those scenes.
Yeah.
And he's the one who was shooting the.
I'm not sure who shot the footage.
It was Eric.
It was Eric.
Yeah, and he used to date Courtney,
right?
And then he started shooting. He was the one that shot, and so he went to Brett a couple years ago and was like, "Hey, I have this tape. I don't know what's on it, but you can have it."
Like I read that basically, Brett Morgan was approached by Courtney a while ago, 2007.
I didn't know it.
And
I haven't read much about the making of this film.
Yeah, I just read a little bit. And it's Francis Bean has a producer credit on the end of it, which is interesting because like, a lot of it is just speculation about her being born on methadone
and
stuff like that, which I wouldn't probably want to be, you know, in my legacy. But
she was born literally in the spotlight.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember when she was born. It was such big news.
Yeah.
You know.
But But I think, like, it's interesting because now it's almost like, who cares what Sassy wrote? It's been, like, so much. It's, like, 25 years later? It's been so long. And it's, like, the things that you're getting caught up in, like, are don't seem like they ultimately would matter now, like, what the press thought. Mm-hmm. Even though it was different then. Like, you did depend on the press mm-hmm. to promote everything. I mean, like, I don't know if they would have functioned better in, like, an era like now where it's just like, oh, there's just new content every day and you're just a blip in a story.
Well, and you have people now.
You have people to help you handle all
this
stuff.
You hire a phalanx of public assistance people that will help you out, you know. And
I'm sure they had a publicist back then sorting all the stuff out for them. But
I would think.
But then when he's probably going off the rails and, like, not showing up for interviews or canceling tours or ending up in a hospital, that's they can't control all that stuff. Yeah, there's not like a close person in their inner sanctum who's like, I guess that's why people were nervous about Courtney, right? Because she's the closest thing to that, like a manager or something for them. I don't know if they had a manager. I assume they had a manager at that point, but like the idea, like, what if Cobain had like a Twitter account or some other direct way to like interact with his people. It's hard to say because I kind of feel like if he had survived to now, that would just be like, oh, that was a weird period of my life. He would still, it'd be like when you see, like, you know, Maron just did an interview with David Byrne. He's just like an interesting guy.
Yeah.
He's just like, I keep doing stuff.
Well, and David Grohl obviously did very well.
Yeah.
I don't know what Chris did. Did he just retire?
He got into politics
stuff. Yeah. He's a big political guy.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. I think he started a what was his organization? I forget. He was involved a lot in the WTO stuff.
Oh.
And he was playing in a couple bands for a while. I don't think he does now. But yeah.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Did you guys did it seem odd to you that David Grohl wasn't part of the talking heads of the documentary?
He was conspicuously absent for sure. And so, and Pat wasn't in there either. Pat Smear wasn't in there.
Yeah. I mean, this is David Grohl is someone who hasn't shied away from talking about his years in Nirvana.
No.
But he wasn't in this doc. I just thought that was so odd.
Maybe because of the Courtney issue. I mean, I think there's sort of camps have been divided, but then Kurt was in it. I feel like the more vocal, there's that one funny moment where Dave Grohl basically calls Courtney, like, makes fun of her haircut or something, and she just storms off. I thought that was hilarious.
Right.
Because it just really is just like, there's not as much at stake at that point. It's just they just didn't get along. They're just, like, snarky people.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought that was funny.
Yeah, there were some people that were missing, I thought, like management, and I thought maybe they would have hit up, you know, his people at, you know,
Buzz
or A&R
people.
Yeah,
the Melvins guys, even.
They might have all that I mean, I heard that they spoke to Dave Grohl, but that they didn't use the footage or something.
That's weird.
Yeah, I mean, it did feel, it was over 2 hours.
Yeah, it was long.
But I mean, maybe it could be as simple as that Dave Grohl is so massive now, and he just did that Sound City thing, and he did the Sonic Highways.
Yeah.
So he's sort of everywhere right now in on film, so maybe they were just like, okay, well,
yeah.
On a side note, did you watch any of the Sonic Highways?
I just saw a couple of them.
They're good, right?
Up until
the song at the end. That's when
I liked
turned it
the
off.
Ones. I liked which ones did I see? I watched the Chicago and the DC one, of course.
Yeah,
but the Austin one's really good.
Yeah, I do find like this having the song be the big reveal at the end was kind of a letdown to me. I'm like, I just want to kind of see more.
That's when I turned it off. Yeah. I was like, sweet, I'm going to watch the next one.
Did you ever play shows with the Foo Fighters or?
Yeah, a lot.
So you kind of know him a little bit more.
A little bit, but like I, you know, and like we're like rock friends, you know, like
right,
like not really.
Show friends. Yeah,
like we played with Scream. We played.
Oh,
with,
you played with Scream. Wow.
We played with Nirvana, and we played with Foo Fighter. We did like an Australian tour with the Foo Fighter, a big thing there.
Oh wow!
And we did a bunch of dates in the States with them and Tammy and the Amps. So, yeah, super nice guy. Like all of those guys.
Right.
Yeah, it's like the Sunny Day Real Estate guys were in it, right, at that point when you, when you toured with them.
Did you ever play with a band called The Dills?
Oh, from San Francisco?
Yeah.
No.
Well, they wouldn't have. They probably broke up in like 85.
Oh, right? Earlier.
Yeah, they were already done.
They were an earlier punk band.
Class War? Class War and all that?
That's. I asked that because my buddy Emmett, who hopefully will be listening to this, he and I played with John, who was the drummer from The Dills.
Okay.
And we used to have to go pick his ass up from the Tenderloin in this five-story walk-up and grab all his drums. Oh, and he didn't have, like, he didn't have drum, boxes or anything. So it was, like, everything
was cases.
No cases. Everything in plastic bags. And
good man.
Worst. It was the worst.
A real player right there.
Yeah.
And he was grumpy.
Well, that's another thing I think is interesting. Like, all these people that were peers of you guys are like people that maybe their bands never really got anything, never put out an album or anything. And this idea that you can, you know, would they be dedicated or would they still be just playing for the love of the playing at this point in their lives, or if they financially didn't need to do it anymore? I mean, like, I guess that's more of a speculative what if question, or just, I think about that too with just, you know, as someone who has been in a bunch of bands and I've essentially given it up.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm pretty much by default, I'm just like, well, that's weird to think that that is like a pastime in my life.
Now. Yeah. Now you're a podcast.
Right. Like you hung them up. Like you hung them up.
I sold a bunch of stuff. I'm like done. And I never was in a band that had anywhere near the success of, you know, it, like, you know, very few people know who my bands were. And I spent like almost 10 years doing this stuff.
Right. It's a crapshoot. I mean, the entire creative entertainment world is a crapshoot.
Right.
And sometimes you're Nirvana and sometimes you're, you know,
George Chen.
George Chen.
Or well, you're wasting, you know, I think you're wasting your time if you, like going back to what you said about how sort of perfectionist and obsessive Kurt Cobain seemed to be, in looking at his notes anyway, about his group being wanting to be great. My takeaway was that he wanted to be great and not that he wanted to be famous, because he didn't, obviously he wasn't the kind of a guy who really craved, you know, look at was like, look at me,
right.
He was not that dude. And that was my okay, and going back to what I said about impression, my impression of him in the limited time that we spent in proximity to that band was that he would have been super happy if no one was looking at him. You know what I mean? Like, some people want people to look at them. He wasn't that guy. He didn't seem like that guy to me.
Yeah.
So there's that. That was kind of my takeaway, was that he just, and it comes out, it's manifest in the other thing that I took from the film, which was like, look at how effortless his playing looks. He's so good at singing and playing his guitar,
well,
that it looks
point,
like he doesn't even give a shit about it.
He was laying on the stage at one point.
Yeah. Nailing the song.
The song. Exactly. I was like, how the fuck is he doing that?
Yeah, but, and really, and then right when, like, the sun comes out in that movie when they cut to the MTV Unplugged session.
Oh, yeah.
Now that I look back on it, that might be Nirvana's finest hour.
Absolutely.
Like, that was incredible how beautiful and amazing that sounds.
Yep.
But, like, he doesn't seem, you know, to look at him on screen, you've been watching him all the movie, and then all of a sudden he seems like he's happy.
Yeah.
He seems like he's clean and healthy. He just seems like really in that moment.
Yeah.
And it really is great. That's like, I was like, wow. And I sort of left it like, man, what a what a great musician.
Yeah, sort of they even show him like tuning up and asking for requests, you know, which I don't ever remember seeing. I don't remember.
No, that must be outtakes.
Yeah, it was in, like, outtakes. An outtake. Yeah,
right.
And
right.
He was like, yeah, he's like, what do you guys want to hear? And it's, I was like, wow, that's so cool. Like, he's at the height of his fame and he's still like, what do you guys want to hear?
Doing Meat Puppets covers.
Yeah.
Also, it's like they're so good at doing covers.
God, I love
too.
The Meat Puppets.
They actually, like, I mean, like, Love Buzz is a cover. Like, I didn't realize that until much later.
Right.
That's like Shocking Blue. Oh, and I didn't it got know. Me a little bit into checking them out. Yeah. When I think about, actually, I feel like I the know. Melvins part of the story is the thing I've seen in a lot of other stuff, is just like how important the, like, I think in Our Band Could Be Your Life, it really lays it out like, they didn't even know that you could be in a band until, like, they saw the Melvins. Like, it's, like, a huge part of their...
Yeah,
that and was... they got a lot of direct, like, even those just steps, like, let's record a demo, send the devil... Dale plays on some of the recordings. Like, it really... Like, that's... Those steps... Like, you talk about the big brother in your life who
right.
turns you on to stuff.
Right.
It's literally that playlist. He's like, Buzz gave me a mixtape. It
right.
has Shocking Blue on it.
Yeah.
Like, there's so many, like just prototype. The Wipers, I'm sure that he hadn't heard the Wipers before that.
Right.
So that's like a big...
The Melvins piece. Were like the stepping stone, the gateway band for so many bands.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And when you look at, like, their career, they never had a hit,
mm-mm.
but they arguably have a better career than any other band from that 90s period. They're still active, and they have, like, a cult, huge cult following. So in a way,
well,
like,
they're no Soul Coughing, but
right. Oh, that guy has a huge cult following too. I don't really understand that, but yeah, like almost like that's like a better model for how to be a sustainable artist. In
yeah,
a way, is the
well,
Melvins.
Yeah, well, it's like what you're saying is that you would like to think that Kurt Cobain would have sort of aged out of that mm-hmm. his mm-hmm. despair into just sort of like. Yeah, you can have a career just playing 500 seaters for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
It's cool, you know.
That'd
just,
be sweet.
It'd yeah. be amazing.
That's what they do.
And yeah. and that's what's really it breaks your heart that it didn't yeah. come to that, you know what I mean?
It 27 is so fucking young.
It's so young.
It's he was like a child. Yeah, it was a,
it
he was a
really
kid.
It really seems so young to me right now.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
How much he could else he could have done.
Oh yeah.
And
so what he could have done with electronic music, I'm sure you probably would have gotten into that.
Like the Bob Mould record. I shouldn't say anything bad about Bob Mould because we still want him to come on the show.
Yes, we do. Bob, if you're listening, come
Bob,
on our show.
No, he seems great. But yeah, but I mean the drug stuff, I don't understand. I've never been a drug guy.
Well, how old are you?
40. So I've never been a drug
so,
guy.
So but you do you another thing I was thinking about coming when I was coming over here was what did we know? We were all pretty sure that those guys were probably doing hard drugs
yes.
that him and Courtney.
I didn't know about Novoselic, but I mean
No, not those guys. I mean specifically sure. I remember sort of it was sort of out there in the ether that like these guys were up against it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or that these two that
like Kurt
and
Courtney. Yeah, that was definitely in the news and I didn't even really understand what heroin was even. I think I was very naive. I didn't yeah. understand.
Well, like, especially when he overdosed in Greece.
Yeah.
Was it in forgive me, but do you know if it was it like public domain that his overdose in Italy or wherever it was
in
was
Rome, yeah.
was that did people know about that
yes.
until
yeah it was considered like
he was
a,
in the papers
near, he was in a coma
yeah
so it was like a near death
yeah he
thing
I remember he took like 50 roofies.
Well, they say like 60 Rohypnols or something
oh yeah,
yeah.
But I mean, did they spin it? I don't remember this. Did they spin it like it was an accident, or did they say like, "Oh, this was a suicide attempt"?
No, I remember it being spun as a suicide attempt.
They did.
I don't think I was paying that much attention at the time, honestly, because I was a little bit. I'm like, oh, they're for everyone. They're
okay, yeah, that's neither here nor there. I can't remember what my original thought was, but I interrupted you. You were saying that you were never a big drug guy.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, I to the point of being very naive about it, I'm sure there was a lot of people that were around the scene, like the San Francisco scene specifically. You know, I know, and even to the point, I just don't know when people are on drugs. That's just a naivety.
You have no drug
dar. I don't have a very good drug dar. I mean, I know, like, I was hanging out with Gilman in the early 90s. Like, there was... you know, underage drinking, and I'm sure there was like people doing harder stuff,
yes.
but I just am never really
there for sure were. And I was always surprised at who was doing it. Cause I'm not great. I don't have like a good, like drug radar either.
Mm-hmm.
But plenty of people around me were.
Yeah. And like you guys were part of a couple different scenes, right? Cause you're kind of Gilman scene. But did you start in L.A.? Did you guys start the band in L.A.?
Well, yeah, Blake and I started playing together in high school in Los Angeles, and then we both ended up in New York City going to school. And then we met Chris there and then started playing and then took it back to L.A. for a year to try it and make demos and play around. And then everyone finished the school and we just sort of we came to San Francisco. That was sort of the compromise. Like, well, let's not go back to New York. We just were there this whole time. Chris headed Los Angeles, so we came here. This is where all our best shows were anyway. Coming through it, like, we would play at Covered Wagon and Gilman and they were playing us on the San Jose station, and we would always have great shows up here. So,
was the Paradise Lounge around then? Was that?
I think it was.
Oh yeah, it was. But I don't think we ever played there. Oh.
Yeah,
if you play. And you guys moved to the Mission. Did you guys have like a house for all of you guys?
Yeah, we lived on Sycamore Street.
Oh, nice
band house
right between Valencia and Mission.
I like the story in the doc when his mom said that Kurt came down the stairs in his tidy whities, as she said, and played his demo tape for her.
The mixes. I'm never mind.
Yeah, and she said to him, "You're not ready for this."
Right. Like, she knew immediately.
She knew. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
Like, that's nuts. Yeah. A, that she had such an ear that she knew it was going to be a hit, and B, she knew her son well enough to be like, "You're not ready for this."
Yeah.
You know, you're a little scared guy.
Right. Yeah. That was, yeah, I liked hearing from his mom in that movie.
Yeah. And
that was the one perspective, I think, that was kind of new.
Because,
you know, I knew, we'd all read some stuff and seen Kurt and Courtney and
all. The ex-girlfriend, too. I felt like I got a lot out of that, like, just seeing what their relationship was like and just seeing just this really sweet relationship.
Yeah.
Tracy, the girl that he was with in Olympia.
Right.
Yeah.
And that she was willing to help support his,
that was shocking to me too,
his thing. And like, it didn't make it sound like she was taken advantage of. It just made her sound like a really cool person that saw like someone's potential
really
and wanted to foster
him.
You know what I mean? Like, that was, I thought that was great.
I mean, there's a lot there. I think there's a lot that we can't really know or speculate about his relationship with his mom. It seemed like he had a lot of resentment with both his parents. I think you were talking about that scene when they're interviewing his dad and stepmom, and she's doing all the talking,
right?
And you just see the dad just like grip the edge of the sofa,
yeah,
like he's like, oh, all of that repressed like feeling coming out.
Yeah.
And yeah, just seeing like how, what a reserved kind of person he was. And then his mom looks like Courtney. I mean, that's definitely like a thing. He's got a type, I think.
Oh, whoa.
His mom looks like Courtney.
Oh,
I think.
That's interesting.
Yeah, like there's definitely like a similarity, but yeah, like the parents,
like a kind of a like a rock and like a Stevie Nicks rock queen.
Yeah,
of,
I think that there is, but like that other relationship with Tracy seemed like he was getting this nurturing that he was missing in his childhood.
Yeah,
it seemed very maternal.
I mean, there was a lot of. It's hard not to see if that movie and not like psychoanalyze it or whatever.
Retroactively
psychoanalyze it, because it's really just about this person's troubled person.
Yeah. Was there something that you wanted to know more about that wasn't presented in the doc?
Not really. I mean, I kind of didn't take, it wasn't, nothing was like revelatory, is that the right word to use? Like, I didn't think like, oh my god, I had no idea. Like, we all kind of know that
the
whole story's
been told,
except for maybe the early on stuff.
Yeah, like with the journals and like the way they brought those illustrations to and animated those, I thought was interesting.
Yeah,
when I was telling George when we were talking about doing this podcast last week, and I was like, I can't understand why Kurt 20 years later is this icon, or where you might see a shirt, his face on a t-shirt at Urban Outfitters or something. Like, he's beyond a person now.
Like, and Bob Marley or Jim Morrison.
Well, you said he's our generation, or the new generation's Jim Morrison.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh god, I never thought about it like that. Like, Jim Morrison, when I was in high school, was this bigger than life presence, you know, of rock and roll, and Yeah, it's kind of interesting because I never would have thought. To me, I was like, eh, it's just Kurt Cobain.
That's like familiar rock and roll narrative is his story, you know, even dying at 27, which is the age of all of those other, yeah, everyone.
Janis Joplin.
Yeah. A lot of
Buddy Holly.
27 Club, yeah.
I'm sure that has so much to do with it.
Right, like if he had lived and was like just a guy who was in Nirvana, you know, who knows? We don't know what it would be like. It's arguable that, yeah, that legacy would still be like, oh, those 90s guys. You know, yeah, that's what the legacy would have been.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You don't know.
But kids, like, I have kids who are, that listen to rock and roll music, and you know, new kids, they go through Nirvana is a step in your rock and roll,
mm-hmm, right,
thing. You don't skip that step.
How old are your kids?
I have a 13-year-old and a 17-year-old.
That's prime rock age.
So, you know, that's, mm-hmm, something that you check in with. You have to do that. Like, you have to do your...
You're right. You do diligence of...
Yeah, you start with the Beatles and you just work your, yeah, way all the way through.
That's true. And once in a while, the Root might take you to...
Or before the Beatles, excuse me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm talking about myself. Like, that was my first, like, obsession was Beatles. But, you know what I mean? You really have to... Do your stuff.
Yeah, that's why the music tree is so fascinating, because you can go left and get into Zappa.
Right.
Or, you know, you can go right and get into the Doors or something, and then, you know, and then all of a sudden you're listening to Captain Beefheart that leads you, you know. That's why it's so fascinating, that stuff.
Yeah, for sure. Nirvana, because they did all these covers, and, like, you could discover, like, the Vaseline's, you could discover, like, the Meat Puppets, you could discover, right, Shocking Blue, like, all this stuff. You could kind of, the Wipers...
Yeah.
I think I first heard The Wipers when there was that tribute album to The Wipers, and they were on there. But I was thinking of a thing when you mentioned, like, having a daughter, and, like, I think this moment when Frances Bean is born, and you kind of see this new side of them as people, as parents. You see Kurt and Courtney as parents, and I think that's another thing that we haven't really, like, seen. Like, maybe there's photos, but we didn't, like, see... Like, this moment of, like, Courtney just, like, singing to Frances and rocking her. And it's just like, whoa, like, that did feel revelatory to me in a way of just, like, oh, that's to me, maybe the bigger tragedy is, like, you know, this girl who's now the executive producer on this movie,
right,
like, didn't get to really know her parents.
Right.
Fully.
And in this, I think the suicide note from Rome... Mm-hmm. Was like, it said at the bottom, you know, Frances will be better off without me in her life.
Oh, it's heartbreaking.
Yeah, it is heartbreaking.
You're no, like, I just thought, yeah.
You're like, of course not. You're a dad. You're like, no one's better off without their dad. You know, yeah. That's just such a weird.
Yeah. I mean, anyone in the throes of whatever that guy was going through, it's just, they're not thinking clearly.
No,
you
of
know?
Course not.
They're just, they're not them. They're, you're not yourself.
Yeah. And again, 27 is pretty young. You know, that's, yeah, such a young age.
They really pushed that the stomach pains were, like, a huge thing for him, and, like, how he was in this constant pain.
Yeah.
And, like, basically the drugs were a way to medicate that. So
right.
There is a part where you could just say, like, that's something that we could have, maybe that's somewhere that fell through the cracks, and there could have been another way to deal with,
yeah,
you know, regulating his pain. But I mean, I do think, like, you see him as a father in a way that I don't think I really, like, comprehended, like, oh, that's what it's like. He's with, it's sad, yeah, when he's, like, nodding off with his daughter in his lap, but it's like you see also this sort of brightness in him.
Well, there's
that moments. Brightness of that he had when he was a little kid, you see, yeah, in the home footage. You just see there's, like, this sort of spark that you don't think of as a sullen dude, like,
right,
he's got a little bit of this extra motivation.
I loved seeing how goofy he was, you know. It seems like he would have been, like, really fun just to hang out with him and play jam and make, yeah, up tunes. And
yeah. Well, in this, you ever watch that Sam Jones show?
I have not.
He had Dave Grohl on, and they talked a little bit about Kurt and what a great sense of humor that he just said he was hysterical.
Yeah, yeah. He seems like a practical joker.
He brought Bobcat Goldthwait on tour with him.
Did he?
Yeah, Bobcat Goldthwait always talks about touring with Nirvana and, like,
yeah,
being at the Oakland Coliseum and, like,
the open.
Yeah, Bobcat was there introducing them at the Aragon.
Oh, so when you toured, was he on the tour with you?
He was at that show.
Okay.
So he introduced Mudhoney and Nirvana, but he didn't introduce us.
Wait, and so all he would do is introduce? He wouldn't do a set?
No, you would, like, get up on stage and do a little bit, probably,
yeah,
and then just, like, introduce the band. I think he just might have been in Chicago that time.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
But I remember specifically going up, like talking to Bobcat because we had just seen Shakes the Clown.
Oh, right.
And we were like, dude. And Howard Stern had shit talked him on the air or something, or didn't like the movie. And we were like, come on, man. Shakes the Clown was great.
Oh, it's
we
amazing.
Loved it. And he was like, thanks a lot, you guys.
Were you there when he came to the store?
Yeah, I didn't mention it to him.
Oh, yeah.
I did Shakes the Clown, the live reading with him. Last year.
Yeah,
with Kevin Pollak and Rick Overton and Florence Henderson, Lorraine Newman.
Amazing.
It was one of the best moments of my life.
What part did you have?
I had Tim Kazurinsky's part, Adam Sandler's part.
Oh, you had Sandler's part.
I had like six different parts.
Did you do the Sandler voice?
No.
Oh, hey, great lady. Oh, this clown is too sad.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was one of the best experiences of my life.
But going back to that tour, I'm sure you've told stories a million times.
Yeah.
If you have any stories from that tour, I'm sure.
Okay, well, I mean, I'm thinking those. Like sort of going through it, there was... we met those guys in Albuquerque, and by the way, took a fair amount of shit from the punk community for even taking that gig.
Right.
Like,
oh, the punk
it was
community.
Never a question that we were going to say yes to that. We were like, when do we start?
Yeah,
let's
when
get
and where?
The fuck out there now.
Yeah.
So we were down. We were like, we're going on tour with those guys.
How shitty would you feel if you had turned it down because someone at MRR was like going to...
Well, that would never
you would have
happened.
No story. Like you just like gave up that story because the punk community was not going to.
No,
like
no,
the
that
tour.
Was not, and it, that came out later. But like, what I'm saying is that we knew that they were going to jump on us for that. You know, we knew that if we accept that, we're going to take shit.
And
but
Nirvana
we didn't give
was
a fuck. We,
huge at this point.
Yeah, yeah, they were massive. They're the biggest band in the world, and so we knew we'd get thrashed. But fuck it. We went. We were happy to go, and there's no regrets. Mm-hmm. And we knew there would never be any regrets about that. So anyway, we met them in Albuquerque, and we're in some just massive place where we had no business being at this place. And we like finally our little Dodge 86 Dodge finally finds the shed where we're playing, and we get there and we go into this little backstage area and Kurt came in to sort of welcome us to the tour. He walked in backstage and was like, thanks for doing it, or whatever he said. And then Blake's tuning up his guitar, and he goes, oh, I got to show you something. And him and Blake take off. And what?
Oh, they're both lefties.
Yeah. So he takes them to wherever their backstage area is. And shows him what he had just gotten built, which was a Jagstang. It was like a Jaguar and a Mustang mashed up into one guitar. All of the specs were his, and it was like this custom cool thing. And but what he said to Blake was, he goes, because, you know, I too am left-handed. Like as if we didn't know that Kurt Cobain was left-handed.
That's charming.
He was telling Blake, like, you know, I'm a lefty too.
Ah, oh, that's sweet.
Like we hadn't seen it a million times. Like you knew that if you rode in an elevator to your doctor's, you knew that he was, you know, a left-handed guitarist, and they were playing "It Smells Like Teen Spirit," you know, through a Moog or whatever. Anyway,
oh, that's cool.
So that was amazing. I just thought that was really funny. We got a really big kick out of that. Like, yeah, we know you're lefty. Like,
yeah.
I'm sorry, I took the thunder out of that.
No, it's fine. No, it's okay,
George.
And so he showed him his guitar, and it was cool. And we played the shows, and after the first show in Albuquerque, someone had thrown. I was like taking my shit off the stage or something, and I found a pair of shoes on stage, like. Pair of like Pumas that fit me. I was like, excellent. I got a pair of shoes out of the gig at least. And I showed Kurt. I was like, check it out. And he was like, dude, come on. Someone's walking home right now with no shoes on. And he took the shoes and like took them to like Lost and Found or something.
Wow. Jeez.
And I felt like a real heel. I was like, oh man.
Those are sweet shoes though.
Those were perfect. I felt like a total prick, of course. It didn't even occur to me that there's some barefoot kid in Albuquerque, like walking home through broken glass. And then I, you know, I know that he was on tour with Courtney was around, and so was Francis was around too, as a little baby. And they were kind of milling around, and I have footage of like our roadie Bill Schneider like playing with Francis and just, you know, backstage and just kind of chatting with Pat Smear and all them. They were all very, very gracious and nice to us and very welcoming. And, you know, there was like banquet before the show and everything. And what was really cool was that they let us, was that mine?
No.
They, you know, we weren't really making any money on that tour. A couple hundred bucks probably or something. But, they made sure that the hall didn't take any of our merch, no percentage of our, like, I don't know if they were selling it for us or if they were allowing us to set up a table near their shit, but they made damn sure that we didn't have to pay the VIG to the hall, which was to us considerable. But just that they had to go through that and had to go and tell somebody, like, look, make sure you do these guys a solid and let them sell their shit, mm-hmm. because they can't, you know, they're not Nirvana. So I thought that was really cool too. In the moment, I remember thinking that was the stand up cool thing.
Wow, that's really cool.
And then I remember coming off this. Okay, so we played our first set and we're scared shitless and I'm not sure if it's great or whatever. And then coming off stage, I noticed Kurt was just sitting on side stage, just listening through like the monitor mix or whatever. And being like, oh shit, like this guy doesn't have to be here. There's three buses that he could be watching a movie on right now, hanging out with his kid, but he was like there to check out the opening band. So I was super grateful for that and thought that was pretty fucking glamorous, because there's the man himself checking out our band. And he even asked Blake, you know, are you going to play Bivouac on this tour or whatever? And thinking that, like, of course, of all songs, like, I don't know if you know Jawbreaker songs, but, like, Bivouac is our 10-minute closer song that you can't bounce back from. It's our slowest and heaviest and craziest song. Anyway, of course, that was the one that he wanted to hear.
He's like, Callie on that tour, too? Is Callie, like, watching?
Callie was, I think he was, God, yeah, I'm pretty sure he was. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, who's Callie?
He was a nanny.
He was the nanny. One of the nannies.
Right, one of the nannies to Francis. Oh. Cool. Who is the guy who played Kurt, the Jawbreaker music?
Right.
That's how they got the gig.
Yeah, he turns up on some of their artwork and stuff, I think. Like, I remember, like, the backstage passes were a picture of Callie, like, in crazy clothes in a bathtub or something.
I remember, this is completely off subject but not off topic, but I just also remember when Kurt wore that Daniel Johnston t-shirt.
Yeah, that's like, in the movie he's got the Daniel Johnston
t-shirt. Yeah, that was a big thing when I was, because I loved my brother used to always order his stuff out of the back of, I think, Rolling Stones, and
we're, right, it's validating, and you see something familiar like that, you're stoked, right? You're like
the homemade flipper shirt.
Yeah, the hi, how are you, and yeah, I just thought that was cool. It seems like Kurt, it goes to your story, it just seems like he's very conscious of like other people who are doing cool stuff and wanting to help people out. And
yeah, for sure. And you know, they weren't around a whole lot. I didn't see a whole lot of Kurt and Courtney on that tour because, like I said, they had three buses to occupy themselves in, and we were just kind of running around like we, you know, it was hilarious to us. Anyway, we at some point in Chicago, I think, maybe. I remember the whole, when we did see him, that he was being trailed by a photographer. Like a guy, I don't know if who had hired this man, but he was just like a shadow. He was like Kurt's shadow, taking pictures of him with every person that he spoke to. And every movie made, there was this photographer clicking away. And, you know, I'm super starstruck. So from the get-go, I'm like, oh, my God, there's the guy, you know, like, don't, you know, that thing, like, don't look at him or something.
Yeah, don't look him in the eyes.
Right. But I kind of was watching him dealing with people and having this guy clicking away, and I caught, like, I overheard him as I was watching this happen backstage in Chicago, I think. He turns around and he kind of leans into the photographer guy and really quietly under his breath, he goes, can you just leave me alone for a little bit? Let me just be here and stop taking pictures. Like it was clear to me that he was not comfortable being that guy.
Hmm.
Just having a dude up in his grill clicking away pictures constantly.
Yeah.
And he finally, and he very politely just was just like implored, yeah, like, can you just give me a fucking break here just for a minute? He didn't even swear at the guy. He just said, can you please give me a minute or something? And I remember that very specific moment thinking like, man, it must be really difficult for this guy to be who he is right now. Because he was clearly just not into it. He just wanted to be backstage with everybody else and hanging out and like having food or, you know, noshing on.
That would be super annoying.
Your M&Ms or whatever.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I remember that happening and sort of being noting that in my head, like this is difficult for this guy to be in this position, to be the man, to be the guy. And to be the face and all that. And Courtney said something about it in the movie too, which sort of supported that idea, which was she said that he just wasn't, he wasn't like a narcissist. He didn't know that he was like this incredibly talented and handsome and, you know, charismatic person.
The girls did love the guy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I remember my girlfriend in college, she's like, I love Kurt.
Yeah,
she loved him.
And it was something that he didn't put that on. At no point in any of that footage in that documentary do you look at it and go, he's posing or he's making faces. He's just totally doing whatever his thing is. At least that's sort of my impression. Mm-hmm. He's not kind of strutting around, you know, with his like glamorous. Whatever square jaw, you know.
Even the way he talks about his like his sexuality is really interesting because it's just like this awkward. He's like, I'm awkward and I have like acne and I'm scrawny and all these things. Like, well, he doesn't have the self image that is like really like he has an ego clearly as an artist,
right?
And that's what really is more of the thing than him wanting like, oh, I want like. My face on the cover of a magazine. I'm just gonna wear these giant, like, you know, giant sunglasses that block most of my face and kind of, you know, mess with the gender binary a little bit and, you know, be like that is the way he wants to present himself. It's not like I'm gonna be Brad Pitt or whatever, which is what Courtney says. She's like, he's cuter than Brad Pitt, you know?
Right.
So,
yeah, I remember D from L7 said something very similar to me years ago about that. She was just joking with her boyfriend at the time, and she said, I like Kurt because he doesn't know he's good looking or something like that.
Yeah, I think I've heard that from other. Yeah, there's a thing that girls love.
It is.
Who doesn't know he's good looking?
Yeah.
Like, anyway,
look, I really don't know it.
Yeah.
I really don't.
So that and then. So, and my other like memory of that tour that we did was him sort of just thanking us at the end, giving us like stuff. Like he gave me something, like he gave me a little rubber stamp that someone had given him. And it was just like a token of like, it wasn't like he bestowed it on me either. He goes, you want this thing? Someone just gave me this. And I was like, fuck yeah, I want that. Like, this is, and I still have it. It's a little rubber stamp of a monkey.
Oh, wow.
And it says Nirvana. Like, someone just gave it to him as a gift or something. And he didn't, you know, he's not going to be bothered to take everything that everyone gives him. So he just sort of doled it out to people, it seemed. He said to me, he goes, I think you guys really went over. I think you really did good. Like, he kind of thanked us for coming along. But he said, like, I think you did, that was good. Like, he kind of validated our performance. Because, you know, when you're the opening band and you're opening for a massive band like that, no one in the crowd gives a shit about your dumb group.
And you were going to be...
They're going to boo you off the stage and they're going to give you shit. And, you know, you're going to take your lumps when you're in that position. Because they're just waiting for the main attraction. Yeah. So he was like, yeah, you guys, I think you guys really went over really well. And I was fucking thrilled to hear that from that guy.
Yeah.
Thrilled.
Yeah. And you got to see them every night, too.
We got to see them every single night from side stage from their mix. Like, it sounded amazing.
That reminds me of one thing. When you see, like, early footage of them and they've got the other drummer, which I think is Chad.
Yes.
Channing in the beginning, like, when they're just, like, jamming in the basement. And, like, it really doesn't sound like the same band, even though it is still Kurt and Chris. So I do think Grohl brought a lot to that sound. And as a drummer, you could speak to that. Like,
for sure.
Grohl is like a great drummer.
Great.
And he has like a great... He brought so much in terms of like fills and things to what they were doing. I mean, they're not like super... It's just like his feel is very good.
Yeah, for sure. And doing. I mean, who didn't bite some of his moves that plays drums?
Yeah.
You know.
He's got a very Terry Bozzio kind of feel to him, I think.
I was surprised to see him. Well, first of all, when we first met those guys, I remember Kurt. Dave and Chris were, before they were playing, were just being hysterical backstage. They were having like the time of their lives, it seemed to me.
Yeah, and that one interview where Kurt just tips his head over onto the table, they're just riffing with each other. They're
for
just
sure.
Being goofballs.
Yeah, those guys were
like,
awesome.
I have no patience for that. And he just like checks out immediately.
But those guys seem to be having the time of their life, really. And Dave Grohl was super cool too, because he came up and he goes like, he was talking to me about my sister's band. Like his, you know, he was like, oh, your sister's in the Voluptuous Horror of Karen Black. I love that band. And he... Like, apparently his girlfriend or wife at the time was super into the band and they'd gone to see him and stuff.
Oh, that's so cool.
And he remembered that you and Scream had played together, probably.
Maybe so.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, those are my little sort of memories. And honestly, it's been so long. It's been over 20 years. Yeah. And then knowing... You know, I it's funny how what you remember from those things, but because it was so outrageous for us to be on that tour, I remember thinking in those moments while they were happening, this is something special that's happening. Really pay attention to this. And I felt so privileged to be there that I didn't even want to like be rolling footage on this stuff,
right?
Or you know what I mean, or taking pictures, or like,
yeah.
It was just sort of like, you're here, act like you belong here.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and just have fun and be very, you know, be grateful that you got invited. And that's kind of where my mind was at. But I remember in those moments being like, this is fucking cool, and you're gonna remember this. And then those were my just couple of little takeaways, which sort of supported a lot of what's in the documentary too, which was, here was a guy that wasn't super comfortable and at ease in his fame, but was great, like a great artist.
Yes,
clearly.
Yes, that definitely comes through. Is like the music, and compared to, I remember actually maybe even getting a video from last weekend that was like an unauthorized biography, and like they didn't have the rights to the music. So it'd be like all these clips of like Nirvana on MTV, and then they'd have to play like someone playing a weird knockoff version.
Oh, like a sideways version of like Teen Spirit.
Like the notes are slightly different, like a Too Many Cooks version of Nirvana that's being played.
So they're playing like, Boston's More Than a Feeling in place of It Smells Like Teen Spirit.
And then just having Brett Morgan having access to all of these personal recordings, archives. We didn't even get into the name Montage of Heck, because that was like a mix that he had made. That he
oh, the mixtape.
Yeah.
Right. That went around. That was kind of traded about, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And all of the stuff that was on there, just super crazy, heavy underground music that we all loved. Mm-hmm. You know, he's got like Saccharine Trust on there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's a deep cut for people, yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Go listen to...
I saw
Surviving You Always or Pagan Icons.
Yeah.
Amazing records.
I've got the Pagan Icon in my room.
Yeah.
An album. Was there a big punk scene in San Francisco at the time, in the late 80s, early 90s?
Well, we arrived in like 1991, and the East Bay had a thriving scene with Lookout Records. Maybe. And yeah. And there was like, you know, Crimp Shrine was just ending, Op Ivy was just ending.
You guys
but
play Green Day all the time?
We played with Green Day and up in Davis, but we didn't play a lot of shows together for some reason. I don't know if that's because I don't know, like the whoever might be like, well, we'll get Green Day this day and these guys the other day.
Oh yeah, like it was like overkill to have you guys both be big drawing bands.
When we came up here, we weren't drawing. You know, we couldn't sell out of the telephone booth. You know, we played the Chameleon. Chameleon was like our spot.
Oh, Amnesia now, yeah.
That right.
Chameleon back then.
But the Lookout stuff in the East Bay and the stuff that from that first wave of Lookout bands like Crimp Shrine, Begat, like 15, and then Op Ivy, Begat, Rancid. Yeah. And then Green Day was playing, but all sorts of like all those like really crazy Lookout and very small bands like Plat Retina and Nuisance and. It was a cool, pretty eclectic scene of young kids playing at Gilman for sure.
Yeah.
And then in San Francisco, we had like, it was more.
Epicenter. Later. Yeah.
That was a little bit later. Like when we arrived, it was sort of like that Revolver and Boner Records crew. They were kind of a little bit older, maybe. They were a little bit more. It was like Steel Pole Bathtub band.
Yeah.
And Straw Man and.
A little more intellectual than the Lookout scene, a little bit more like
the Bedlam Rovers, just a little bit older and
commotion,
more
like
commotion exactly.
Yeah.
So we were coming into a pretty established thing, you know, with its own. We weren't helping build it as much as just sort of enjoying it. You know, we did feel a little bit like interlopers here because we were coming from Los Angeles, really.
Yeah. And then the San Francisco punk scene, I think of like the early punk scene, that had been done for a while, like the 79-80 punk scene.
Right. Right.
By the time you were there.
Right. The Dead Kennedys were done.
And like, yeah, it became kind of like post like hardcore. I guess hardcore in LA is a totally different thing. That San Francisco didn't have a ton of like hardcore, I guess.
Right.
But yeah, like I think like the Mabuhay era, that was done by like 85, 86, I think.
I mean, and there wasn't a whole lot going on in LA either at that time. Like when we were starting to put our band together, it was like Pay to Play was happening in Los Angeles. All the hair metal bands were taking over the Sunset Strip. Mm-hmm. They had closed down the Cathay de Grand and anywhere you would, or the roller rink where you'd go see hardcore. Mm-hmm. Like that time after like 19, you know, when Black Flag broke up and D Boone passed away, it was sort of like hardcore kind of ended, really.
It's like 85, 86 ish.
Yeah, like so that American hardcore movie kind of definitely got that right, where something ended, and then Speed Metal crossover started getting big.
And Fugazi. I think Fugazi probably established a lot for that entire scene.
For sure.
Yeah.
So that stuff in DC started coming, like Fugazi and Shutter to Think and them and Rites of Spring or whatever, that kind of post-hardcore thing definitely started that ball rolling again, I think. And I think that we kind of, we had begun our band significantly before, but really started taking off after that kind of era, when people started maybe looking out to, well, there's nothing going on here, like what's happening, like what are the replacements up to, or what's what's happening in Austin or whatever,
Minneapolis
or the Pacific Northwest or Seattle. Then that happened.
Well, I mean, there was that movie that came out that was the year the punk broke, which is 91, this is because of Nirvana, and that includes like Sonic Youth and that, and I think maybe L7 and some of those bands are mentioned in that movie.
We're talking about Dave Markey's movie, I think that was really supposed to have been a Sonic Youth thing, but they had brought along Nirvana maybe on.
It's been a long time since I've seen that one. I mean, I guess it is centered around Sonic Youth, but I think like that's weird because like I remember that Nirvana coming out and being like, punk is back, but it's like it's grunge now.
Right.
And it's had the relationship that punk was having with the identity of punk was I don't think we should count these corporate people that have this money coming from these corporations. Like, all these details that are, like, again, like, and you guys had to deal with this a lot, was a lot of this stuff, which now seems irrelevant because I feel like the idea of, like, even doing Discord, like, I'm going to do $5 shows, I'm going to put out cheap records, I'm going to make a living off record sales, that's gone. That's not even, like, really a thing anymore. I feel like if you're a new band, like, and you're trying to survive now.
I mean, well, there's no sellout. There, no one's talking about selling out anymore.
Yeah, that's gone away.
That went away, yeah, for sure.
Because yeah, there's no money in just selling product. Like there is still a little bit of money, but it's not much compared to what it used to be.
Right.
And so I feel like all this argument, like the punk scene didn't really have, it had like, it was very good at like shutting things down, but not really providing like an alternative way to like make things move forward. When I think about like even like Crass, like you, like Crass has all these reissues now. They're like $25 Crass records.
Right.
Still say pay no more than £5 on them. Like the economics of it, like didn't really, there were also of their moment, but the music lasts longer. So it's like, there was like these weird moments, like when, and I think like you guys got a little bit sucked into that.
For sure.
And like, and Nirvana really had to deal with this, like, guilt or whatever. I don't know how much that really affected them.
I'm well, sure I mean, you want to, you know, obviously it was, it's important for everyone that's doing any kind of work to feel like that they're authentic or whatever, yeah, you know, and you want, and you certainly want your peers on board.
Oh, yeah, like, when you see him as a child and, like, how it's just, like, he was so ingrained in pop culture and how much he was like absorbing from pop culture, like just cartoons and comics, and that sort of seems to be, when you go back to the fact that Montage of Heck is based on, the name is this mixtape that he did, and it's just like him almost doing like a podcast or doing like a college radio show, like he's
totally
just like, I'm just gonna mix together weird little bits of spoken word and music that I love, and like, I guess pass it around to friends. Did you guys end up with a copy of the tape?
No, I didn't know about it until much later.
Oh, until, right, yeah, because it came out recently.
Till recently. Till really recently.
Yeah.
And like, we got those other ones, you know, there was like those other kind of like Great Phone Calls or the Jerky Boys. Oh, all yeah, that stuff was like, that was kind of a thing for a while where like these engineers would like trade.
Yeah.
Do you remember? Stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But like, I didn't have that one for some reason. That one.
Even South Park. You remember right, when that videotape, the yeah, Christmas special, yeah, like that got traded around. I remember going to a party where it was for us to gather, get drunk, and watch that tape. And
it
was
a South Park tape, Brian Boitano?
Yeah, exactly. Amazing. And it was what, like 3 minutes long or something?
Yeah, it was a short.
It was for sure, like maybe 5 minutes. And there's a whole party devoted to this 5 minute short video cassette tape that my friend got because he's from LA, got his hands on.
I remember doing that also.
Yeah.
You just watched that. And those, and the Mr. Show tapes were like that
right,
for a long time before they were accessible.
There's some nostalgia there that.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, so he was obviously a pop culture. I was going to say pop culture junkie. Forget.
But more of a sponge,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, sponge. I was absorbing all the
But stuff. I mean, you remember making your. You're younger than I am, but you made mixtapes.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember how obsessively you would go through those,
yes,
and they had to be just so, and you'd time it out,
yeah,
and like you had to have the right song, and
yeah,
sometimes you'd work in found sounds or like just clips from the weird TV.
A lot of messages to platonic friends that you didn't want to be platonic. That
yeah,
was basically.
I still have my tape deck to my stereo, and I have a tape player in the car.
Now, as someone who is a co-owner of Lost Weekend Video, what would you say you would put on, if you were going to make a mixtape of like documentaries that you love, what are some documentaries you would recommend to our listeners who are, if nothing else, if not just Nirvana or Jawbreaker fans, documentary fans?
Hopefully
like
all
music,
three.
Music docs or
could
just
be music
docs?
Like your favorite docs.
Well, see, I love documentaries, and here's another thing that I was sort of thinking about when I was half-assedly preparing to come over here today.
Sorry.
Is there something? Do you have like? Is there a tea kettle happening?
It ties the phone call.
You can.
Is there a TV dinner that needs to be taken out?
Okay, let's ask this again. So yeah, and also I was gonna say that we have been doing shows at Lost Weekend Video for a while, and you're one of the owners of Lost Weekend Video.
Yep.
So we've been doing comedy there, and I know the store has been going through a lot of ups and downs. If we get any of our listeners to actually come rent videos from Lost Weekend. I know Marwan Calls one that you can get there that's not on Netflix.
Right.
There's a couple of DVDs that you
there's
can get.
There's
we
have
that
we have literally thousands, and I'm using that word in the correct way.
Yeah.
We literally have thousands of things that you can't get on Netflix or on streaming or however you get your stuff. We have many things that didn't even make it to DVD, that weren't even digitized. And we have a lot of music stuff that fits in that.
Like live performance docs and like documentary, like biography kind of docs.
Yeah, but it just all sorts of different stuff. We have a lot of music stuff, though.
Yeah, you guys actually had the last VHS copy of this XBXRX video that I just got back because no one had rented it in years, and like I was in band with those guys. So I was like, hey, can you get a copy of this? Like, no, Lost Weekend still has one. I'm like, yeah, I'm pretty sure I can like just buy it off them and like get you this VHS.
Digitize it for me, man.
Yeah, it's
back
great.
It up for me.
That's the XBXRX video is great. It is not available anywhere. But
well, if you're coming to Lost Weekend to get a, you know, if you ask me what's a good doc, there's so many good ones. But what I was gonna say was I really enjoy documentaries. In the same way that I enjoy reading biographies, more so maybe than like novels. Mm-hmm. Because there's plenty of fiction in biographies, and there's plenty of fiction in these docs that we speak about. Mm-hmm. Because they're edited and they're you go in, you know, your guy goes or woman goes in with a narrative that they want to to flesh out. So there's plenty of fiction in these things too, which made me think, what was the fiction? What was the intent of Montage of Heck? And I think that there wasn't really, I was happy that it didn't seem to have an agenda. Mm-hmm. Right. So I had read that it was a sort of a warts and all thing, but I mean, I didn't see all that many warts. I didn't take too much from that where I was like, oh man, I wish I didn't hear that about this guy, you know?
If anything, it humanized him in my eyes, and I kind of liked him more.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like there's no footage of him shooting up or anything like that. Right. I feel like that's something that would have been a little
right. That would have been sensational, yeah. And it would have been fucking awful. No one would have wanted to see that. But a couple of people that I've spoken to who are in that camp, that Nirvana camp, have told me, like, yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure I want to see it. It might just be too painful. But these are like people that knew that he knew and that they knew him and stuff. But even more sort of, you know, outsider people, like, yeah, I'm not sure I want to know any more about him, just because I'll enjoy his work as his work, and I don't need to know about every little bit.
I didn't think it was like exploitative necessarily. It seemed like it was done with, you know, the well wishes of at least his daughter.
For sure.
Maybe his mom and sister, even though, you know, the mom doesn't come off great or terrible. Mom is just like, well, he was a trouble. He was a handful.
That's yeah, he was energetic and a handful.
But yeah, it didn't seem like it had an agenda. It didn't have a conspiracy.
No, but depending on who's watching it, and this is with any movie, obviously, but I definitely, you know, what am I trying to say? You know, I might watch it with totally different eyes than you. Some people might look at it and go, like, let's look for clues on why this guy self-destructed. Mm-hmm. Other people might look at it and go, wow, this is cool. Let's look at his artistic process or whatever, songwriting or whatever. Mm-hmm. And other people might be like, well, let's look at his relationship. So there's a lot going on there. But yeah, I didn't feel that it really was too really trying to push too much of an agenda, which I was glad about. Mm-hmm. But in terms of other docs, I mean, I loved, you know, all the usual suspects. I mean, like, I loved Grey Gardens and Salesman.
That's what you can get at Lost Weekend Video, right?
Absolutely. Come on down to Lost Weekend Video. We'll fix you right
comedy,
up.
Watch some comedy, rent a documentary.
If you don't go downstairs to watch George Chen get his yucks on down there,
Adam will do a card trick for you upstairs.
I will do a card trick for you. I will tell you stories. I will bore you to tears with my dumb rock and roll stories. I'm good for. I could do it all night.
Thank you, sir, for coming in.
Thank you, guys.
All right. Thanks to Adam Fowler and my co-host, George Chen. Just want to let you know, we recorded this episode before the article from Buzz Osborne of the Melvins came out on Talkhouse. He points out things in this doc that he thinks are inaccurate or untrue.
We would have definitely talked about this article, but we recorded this podcast before that article came out. I would suggest checking out that article if you're interested. You can follow Jawbreaker on Twitter at JawbreakerBand, and of course you can follow SupDoc on Twitter as well at SupDocPodcast. Our site is www.supdocpodcast.com, and if you would like to email us, send us a message to supdocpodcast@gmail.com. Please subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes, and thanks so much for listening.